when he's talking about the denazification, and he's like, yeah, and he had to go through denazification even though he never saluted Hitler or wrote Herr Hitler in all the letters that he wrote to him. Caught him on a technicality.
I know, you know? Yeah. It doesn't count as Nazism if you don't say the magic words. That's right. But I thought it was a great way to show that, like, this cycle has been happening forever. And that, like, as much as it's, like, plays out in the movie through the phones, that this is just something that happens generationally where these social norms get updated and people who got away with the bad things can't get away with them anymore. I'm Max Fisher.
I'm John Favreau.
And with us is Amanda Hess, critic at large for the New York Times Culture Section, author of the forthcoming Second Life, Having a Child in the Digital Age. Amanda, welcome.
Thank you for having me. I just want to say that Second Life is being published by Doubleday, which is also the publisher of Tar on Tar. But
right.
So we do, you know, we are colleagues, like, in that way, just as a
well, I hope that you disclaimer. Don't get bumped to the 53rd Street Barnes & Noble amid personal scandal and student protests as well. Although if you did,
only hope.
Great pedigree. Yeah. Well, don't bring Olga with you. This is the Offline Movie Club. Every episode, we discuss one of our favorite movies and how it reflects or shapes how we think about technology and the internet. This week, we're talking about a big favorite of mine, and I know also yours, Amanda, Tar, the 2022 movie about an industry-leading figure's narcissism and abuses of power bring about their own downfall. That's right. Finally, the Elon Musk biopic is here. Wait, sorry. This is Tar, about the downfall of the fictitious classical music composer. Maybe fictitious. Wink, wink. We'll get into that. All right, Amanda, kick us off. What do you think makes this movie important for how we think about technology and the internet and all the many things associated with it?
I mean, to me, the thing that's most interesting about this movie is, like, the first time I watched it, I was annoyed at how it used the internet, because I was like, this is not how people would use it. This is not how, like, a viral video takedown video would look. And then the second time I watched it, I was like, I think this is a movie about people having different perceptions of how the internet works. And our closest figure we're following, Tar, like, has obviously a very dismissive and general idea of how the internet works, in the sense that, like, she thinks she can just delete some emails that she got and they're just going to disappear from the world and, like, go away. And so I think the movie is about how the internet is really shifting these power structures, but it's doing it in a way that not everybody is on the same page about and not everyone understands in the same way.
Yeah, Cate Blanchett, the Gen Xer not knowing how to use the internet or email, is a great bit. It's one of many things about this movie that's so funny that people did not appreciate the comedy of at the time. John, you had not seen this before, which shocked me. We enlisted you in this episode, and I was like, obviously John has seen this movie 100 times and has thoughts on it.
Well, because I am quite addicted to the internet, I miss some important cultural moments that happens with me.
Yeah.
So I did miss Tar, and I was just telling Max, not only had I not seen Tar, I missed the discourse around Tar.
So always better off for missing a discourse.
Which turned out to be better. It turned out to be a good thing. Because when all I knew about Tar was, it's a movie maybe about cancel culture, and some people seem mad. That's it. That's all I got. So then I watched it. And I think it says two things about the internet that are interesting to me. One, Twitter is real life. Social media is real life, right? Like, and
it has
this idea that being canceled can feel like a death. And I thought it does a good job sort of showing just how,
what that feels like,
just what the punishment is like for someone like Tar. But also, there's one point at the very beginning when she's talking to Adam Gopnik, and she says she doesn't read her reviews. But she's kind of offline. And I do think there's, like, a corollary to being, you can be too offline, like, she just was not, she's so used to being ensconced in this, like, cultural elite bubble where all she has to, she only has to talk to powerful people. Right. She only gets, you know, people kiss her ass all the time. Her assistant is kissing her ass all the time, even though she's texting someone. I assume that it's the assistant that's doing that, about how awful she is.
Yeah.
And so you can live in this bubble if you don't get any criticism or you don't take in any criticism. And then it just sort of fuels the narcissism.
Right. Because she's so good at knowing how to manipulate and play within her world.
Where she has power.
Right. Where she has all this power that she's not even aware of this other world that is rising up parallel to her yes. on the internet. Yeah.
Yeah.
I did think that that was, and that was kind of to your point too, Amanda, that it's, you know, the movie is like not, it's not really about the phones. It's not really about the internet. And its portrayal of them, like, on its face is like kind of fine and is like not particularly amazing. But the things that it is mostly about do play out through the phones and mm-hmm. through the internet, which is this idea of power structures changing, of social norms changing, of the people who get swept up in that. Before I forget, John, you have got to tell the story about how Cate Blanchett almost came on this show to talk about Tar.
Yeah, I don't know how almost it was.
In Austin's telling, she was like banging at the studio door to be let in to talk about this movie.
No, I think it was, let's just say there was some miscommunication there
or
mixed up communication. Because all I knew was, you know, Austin was like, there's this movie. It's kind of about cancel culture. Mm-hmm. Cate Blanchett starring in it. Mm-hmm. And she might come on the show. Would you want? And I was like, of course I'll talk to Cate Blanchett about literally anything mm-hmm. if she wants to come on the show. But it didn't end up happening.
Well, I would not have let that happen if I was here.
I mean, what a show that would be.
I don't know if you remember this,
what if it was just me interviewing Lydia Tarr?
That was the very first thing I pitched to you when we were talking about, like, should I come in and co-host offline? My first pitch to you, because it was when this movie came out and I had seen it that morning when we met and I was like, our first guest should be Lydia Tarr.
Oh, see, I didn't get it at the time. See, well, it went right over my head.
You laughed as if you got it, which is why I was like, we have to have Favreau onto this. Well, as usual, just being nice does get you into trouble.
That's right.
I think my read was that it was just about just a really great portrayal of the idea of social change and power hierarchies changing and about how power is used and misused and the people who are involved in that. And I think it is like, watching it this time, I was really struck by how, even though I kind of talked myself into like, it's not really about quote unquote cancel culture, it's not really about the phones, the internet. The very first thing we see is, like you said, is Francesca, the Naomi Merlant character, like FaceTiming a video of her, which I think is such a great moment because it's not even clear to me if that like is how that app works, but is it? Like,
I know, I was very confused by that.
I don't know what app that was. It was an old moment for me.
Okay.
I don't either. They're like texting over a live video of Lydia Tarr, which happens frequently in the movie.
Maybe it's Snapchat?
Maybe. I mean, I don't think that's one of the many things where, like, I don't think that Lydia Tarr's assistants and former assistants are texting over a live video feed of her. But I do, like, in the reality in which Lydia Tarr exists, but I do think that Lydia Tarr senses that something like that is happening, that she feels like watched in a way that is like outside of her awareness and really understanding. And that is like a visual representation that Todd Field can use that also allows us to see her while they're texting.
Right.
You know.
Right. And it's also a visual representation of the power inversion. That the first time we see her, she's completely powerless. She's asleep and she's at the mercy of these people around her who are also there to lift her up. So do we think this movie is about cancel culture? Do we think it intends to be about cancel culture? Like, I don't even like that phrase. I kind of hate the phrase cancel culture.
I think it's been ruined. So yeah, I agree. It's like a shorthand because we haven't figured out.
I think we do need a better phrase for it because it refers to a real thing of like social norm enforcement changing over the internet and social media. But yeah, the way that that term has been co-opted or opted, I guess, because that was always kind of how it was used.
Yeah, I feel like cancel culture is a force in the movie, but it's really like this ghost story about the ghosts of her past coming to haunt her and like she deserves to be haunted by them. Like one thing that like, you know, Lydia Tarr becoming this meme where she's like this icon or whatever, Lydia Tarr innocent. Mm-hmm. Like I love Lydia Tarr as she sort of exists like as a Twitter character. And I'm like, she's like vaguely in my awareness sometimes, you know, like at the DNC when there was going to be like a surprise.
Just going to say this.
I love this. Yeah.
Guest. People were like, it's Lydia Jarr. I'm just like so aware of her as this like glamorous icon that when this is, I think, the third time that I watched the movie. When I watched the movie again, I was like, oh yeah, she is awful. Like the things that she does are awful. And she like deserves to lose her job. But one of the things that's interesting about the movie is like many of the ways that she is like taken down are probably unfair. But that, you know, like the video that comes out against her is like this hatchet job that I think also, again, serves to represent that, like, this scene in the movie, which was, so when she's in Juilliard, the scene in the movie is this one shot scene.
That's and
amazing. Then it's incredible. And then when the video is used against her, it's shot from all of these different perspectives. To me, that's obviously like a metaphorical flourish on Todd Field's part. Like that video is incredibly unfair. But that's the tool that's used to take down someone who like truly abuses her power in like really horrific ways, I think.
Yeah.
Also, I thought that was fascinating because if you had released the full video,
right,
that was unedited, she still seems awful.
Right.
Yeah.
Which goes to your point about like, you can, there can be a debate about the tactics that took her down and some of them are unfair and some of them are fair, but there was justice done to Lydia Tarr in this movie, I thought. And so I did, as I started, you know, I watched the movie, I took some notes, and then just before we recorded, I started reading some of the negative reviews. And the idea that, like, she got away with anything, or it sort of like glorifies her.
I know,
I was like,
crazy.
I don't think it did. I think it's a pretty damning indictment of her and powerful people who think that just because they are, they have genius, they can get away with treating people like shit, which is a story of a lot of powerful people.
Right. I actually really appreciated that the movie was, I don't know if neutral is the right word, but the way that it portrayed the like cancellation of Lydia Tarr.
It was nuanced, I thought.
It was very new. And most of it happens off camera, which I thought was really good. Like, we don't even get into like, well, who took the video and why did they take it? And did they have good motives? Did they have bad motives? It's just like, it's something that happens off camera. You don't see it. And it's just this like impersonal force that kind of suddenly overwhelms her, which I thought was perfect because it's a way to portray that it's like, look, maybe you like the people who are making these videos and how they're making them, or people are sending the tweets have good or bad motives, but it's just a thing that happens when social norms inevitably evolve, when one generation like Lydia Tarr's goes from young to older, when they become the people, when they go from the people who are challenging the power, the people who have it, there's a new generation that comes in that challenges that, overturns it, that this is just like the things that happen. And so I really liked that. It's a movie that's very aware of like 2020 and post 2020 and how the internet works and how social media is a force for change. But it makes a very deliberate choice not to say this is good or bad, because it's not what it's about. It's about Lydia Tarr and her use of power and how she gets into that position. Okay, well, we're kind of like well into our first question. What is the biggest thing this movie gets right? I feel like there's so many things we can talk about here. So like, where do you guys want to start?
I mean, I thought this will be, I won't quote this piece too many times, but Zadie Smith writes this review in New York Review of Books that is just fantastic, I thought. But she sort of talks about Lydia Tarr as like the prototypical like cultural luminary. And I do think like it is such an accurate portrayal of the narcissism and just bullshit that you hear from cultural luminaries. I laughed so hard in the movie at the very beginning, just when she mentioned Tarr on Tarr.
It's Tarr on Tarr.
Tarr on Tarr is
so
the
funny.
Funniest. It may have been the funniest part of the movie.
This is one of those movies where
every talk like that, every talk like that sounds like that. Yes. They did such a good job of portraying the like thought leader person who's not just, he doesn't just excel in their field, but excels in everything. And, you know, they're just the bullshit flown out of their mouth. Same stories, same anecdotes, all the same shit.
Amanda, what was the funniest moment of this movie to you? Because there are so many.
Oh, my God. I mean, first of all, I saw this movie in the theater like shortly after it came out. And I don't think anybody else thought it was funny. Like, yes, I didn't hear.
The same experience.
It was so
I was the only one laughing. And I was like, what is wrong with you? This movie is a riot.
I thought so, too.
Yeah. I mean, to me, the funniest moment is when she comes to understand that her daughter is being bullied. And so she takes her to school, which she never does. Mm-hmm. And she isolates the bully and speaks to her in German. And she says, I'm Petra's father in German. To me, that is like the funniest moment of the movie. And then she like absolutely intimidates this girl, which is the first time, you know, it's funny and it's not, because then you realize that like, wow, like she can be a monster. If
she's
she
a monster.
To,
yeah.
To a child. Yeah. Yeah.
I thought it was also a great way to like have the movie a little bit put its finger on the idea that Lydia Tarr, part of the personality that she has manufactured for herself, is like a Harvey Weinstein.
Yeah.
Is that she wasn't, that's like not like who she is. She like made this persona, and to like present herself as male when she is about to go bully a little girl, a little child, this is like, yes, this is what she has built up for herself because it's who she wants to be.
She's also created like a philanthropic like organization that exists to source young women to be her assistants
right.
and mentees. Yes. Yeah, it's amazing.
Her pipeline, the Accordion Institute, which I thought was so striking because then she plays the accordion later when she's having her total meltdown, which I didn't quite know right. the metaphorical connection there, but I believe that there is one and that it's probably great.
I know. We also see her when she ends up going home to her house on Long Island or wherever it is. We see a picture of her as a child playing the accordion, which I guess is a nod to her humble, I don't know, like vaguely ethnic white origins. I'm not sure exactly what it is, but she didn't start playing the piano, I think is what we're supposed to understand.
Right. Yeah. I think her family is supposed to be like Baltic, like Eastern European. Anyway, I thought that the way, like for me, the thing that the movie was most of all about and was best at portraying is the kind of like power, the like Todd Field called it like the pyramid structure that builds up someone who is powerful and the like entire ecosystem that is around bolstering someone who is powerful, not despite, but often explicitly because they are like an abusive monster. He has this quote he gave in an interview. Technically, this is a film about power. Power is a pyramid. What are the cornerstones and how is the apex of that supported? The apex being whoever's at the top. And that is about complicity, and it's about many other things that involve many people. And something that I really picked up rewatching this was how many of her interactions with the people around her are them saying to her implicitly or sometimes explicitly, like, I know what you're doing. I'm okay with it because I'm getting something out of this.
Yeah.
Like her whole scene with, which we have a clip of Sharon, the Nina Haas character, confronting her is like, I don't even care that you basically murdered this woman who you exploited. Like, I just care because you're supposed to involve me in the power games and like the machinations, and you left me out of that one. So let's play that clip.
Do you understand what it was like to walk into my sectional yesterday and to see everybody whispering about me? It's got nothing to do with what they're accusing you of. It's a simple matter of not warning me that our family is in danger.
And then later when she fires Sebastian, which is a great scene. I love the way that he shoots it where it's like this far wide shot. It's really, it's like Kubrick. It's really scary, almost like a horror slasher scene. And where he says to her, like, everyone knows the little favors you grant, even if nobody dares breathe a word of it. And as soon as he says it, he's realized that he's broken some like unspoken rule that like he's allowed inside because he understands who she is, but never confronts her with it.
I also liked that there was a line at some point where someone says every relationship has been transactional. Every relationship with you is transactional except for the
except
one next
for the
door,
one with
her daughter Petra.
Yeah.
And that to me sort of kind of, you know, characterizes the power imbalance stuff more than anything else.
Right.
Because she goes through the world with the same thing, doing the favors, doing these transactions, and never sees anyone except her daughter as like a human,
as
including her
person.
Partner.
Yeah, right. But they're all, which I think was crazy, is they're all in on it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's this sense in the movie that there's one special girl and there can only be one special girl at one time. And we get a sense that like Tarr, like when she was younger, she was chosen as the special girl by men. You know, and now she's like made it her job to select them, probably along similar lines that she was herself selected in a way, in that she's, I guess, supposed to be very talented. We don't like hear her create music that much. I saw this movie like it was shortly after I had a baby. And so I went to the theater and all I knew about the movie was that it was about this conductor played by Cate Blanchett. And I was like, this is great because there's going to be a lot of really loud music. And I like brought my breast pump. I was like, I'm going to pump in the middle of the movie when there's like a big classical music scene. And then it like never happens. It's like such a silent movie where it's just hear these like little tickings and like dings in the whole movie. It's so crazy until the very end. But I guess, you know, she's supposed to be very impressive as a conductor. But obviously, you know, she's surrounded by these men who are fascinated by her, too.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you guys, do we think that she's talented? Do we think she's actually a genius? I think that she's supposed to be a shitty composer. Really? I think like every time we see her composing, she doesn't have any ideas. She hears the like life alert beeping and plays that. And then Olga,
I was thinking, the when cellist Olga comes in melody,
and, like, and then right. fixes it. Yeah.
She's like, this is amazing. I'm like, is that melody amazing?
Yeah. No, I think that we're supposed to see her as like, she's a very good conductor and she really wants to be, which I think it was Mahler who was like also a great conductor who then became a composer. There's somebody who they reference, it might have been Schopenhauer. She clearly wants to be that person and just like can't do it, which I think underscores how much her power comes from her ability to like manage these networks and play within these power structures in a way that works for everybody.
Mm-hmm. It also, to me, a message that came through was that like power dynamics are not always gender dynamics, right? Because it's a little Me Too-ish, the movie. But I think if she had been a man in the movie, it would have felt more familiar.
Right.
And because of who she is, and, you know, I think it was, it just drills down on the fact that it doesn't always have to, it typically is gender,
right?
But it doesn't always have to be gender.
It's primarily about power,
Yeah.
And Todd Fields has said that he felt he had to make that character woman because if Lydia Tarr was a man, you would know in 5 seconds how to feel about him.
Right. It wouldn't feel as nuanced or complicated.
Right.
You'd be
right.
like, oh, yeah, we've seen that before.
Yeah.
Especially like right after Me Too. Like I don't want to know like what Matt Lauer is thinking. Like I don't want to get inside his head and do like a deep character
that
study of a
terrible.
Figure like that. But yeah, I mean, her being a woman sort of allows us to care about what she thinks and also like to celebrate her in a way. Like the reason I think she's become this like weird internet cultural icon is because like she's very glamorous and she's played by Cate Blanchett, and like that would not happen with a male Tar.
Right. She is very, very good at the thing that she does of like creating an image, selling herself. Right.
Which is also that's why it's about the internet.
Yes, that's true. Right.
Because it is very much about the performative aspect of constructing an identity in this age.
Right. Right. The line that she gives to Francesca when they found out that Krista dies, I think is so telling, like the way she words it and delivers it, where she says, there's nothing we could have done to stop her. She wasn't one of us. Mm. But like, she wasn't one of us, I feel like communicates so much that it's like, we have an inner circle. We're all bought in. We're all lifting each other up in this power structure. And like, she's not in the inner circle, so she's not a person. And you shouldn't care about her dying, which like, kind of works. I think Francesca doesn't care. Francesca is like low-key also a monster.
Yeah.
I feel.
Right. I mean, I think one of the most interesting points of tension in the movie is like she has chosen Francesca as her assistant, and like she has this backstory that seems obvious of them having had a relationship, perhaps also with Krista in the past. But then it gets messed up because people start getting onto her. And so she feels like in order to like push off these accusations, she can't elevate Francesca. And that's what sets off this, you know, rampage, it seems like, that happens off screen.
Right.
Where she's canceled.
That was the same reaction. The thing that felt like clicked for me this time around was like, oh, her downfall isn't Krista dying or even Krista accusing her in the suicide note. Her downfall is the people who support her, Sharon and Francesca, deciding to withdraw their support because there's no longer something in it for them, because Tar has to like withhold the job promotion for Francesca because there's suspicion around her now. And it's like the strategic choice that she makes.
Yeah. And to your point about Krista, too, it's not just that, oh, we're all part of this power dynamic and we lift each other up. Mm-hmm. There is this she has this belief that, like, if you're good, if you're talented,
right,
you can be a shitty person.
Sure.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
All that matters is the talent.
Right.
Right. All that matters is the art and the creativity.
Yeah.
And that gives you a license to just get away with anything else and do whatever you want and treat people like they're disposable.
I think that she says that, like, more or less explicitly at some points. And it comes up also in her lunches with the Andrus character, which we also have a clip from I Want to Play. I feel like it's a really great scene where she asks him, and this is her, like, former mentor, about, have you ever had a misunderstanding with a student?
Have you ever had an issue with a student or colleague where that person may have misinterpreted your intention?
Someone been complaining about
no,
me?
No, 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 of course not.
Because at this point, they missed their chance. I'm out of the game.
Yes, yes, I know. Of course you are.
Thank God I was never pulled from the podium like Jimmy Levine, or hunted like Charles Dutoit. I take it you're asking for a reason.
Well, there's just been so much of this sort of thing in the news lately.
Well, nowadays, to be accused is the same as being guilty.
I think there's a great, and then he goes through and lists these composers who were previously accused of or conducted sexual harassment, and one who was a Nazi.
Yeah. He really slips into the Nazi comparison.
Yes.
Fairly quickly and easily.
Right, right. Which, like, she, I think, is so, the way she plays her response is, like, she's initially appalled by it, and then she kind of remembers the game and is like, oh, well, of course you're right. And of course it's fine. And, like, when she brings up Schopenhauer and, like, he references, it's like, well, they tried to cancel Schopenhauer. It's like, well, he tried to kill his wife, so that was bad. And, but then when he waves it off, he's like, Lydia Tarr is like, oh yeah, I guess that's fine, because she remembers that this is her game too. And this is what she bought into.
There's also this line when he's talking about the denazification, and he's like, yeah, and he had to go through denazification even though he never saluted Hitler or wrote Herr Hitler in all the letters that he wrote to him. Caught him on a technicality.
I know, yeah. It doesn't count as Nazism if you don't say the magic words. That's right. But I thought it was a great way to show that, like, this cycle has been happening forever. And that, like, as much as it's, like, plays out in the movie through the phones, that this is just something that happens generationally, where these social norms get updated and people who got away with the bad things can't get away with them anymore.
Are you concerned about microplastics in your home? Blue Land makes it easy to make sustainable choices. Blue Land cleaning sprays, toilet bowl cleaner, and dishwasher and laundry detergent tablets are free from dyes, parabens, and harsh chemicals. Blue Land is a certified B Corp and Leaping Bunny cruelty-free certified. Their formulas are EPA Safer Choice certified, and many products have also earned Cradle to Cradle's Gold Material Health Certificate. Get 15% off your first order by going to blueland.com/crooked. blueland.com/crooked.
If you guys like Positive America, please consider subscribing to our Friends of the Pod program. So Friends of the Pod get lots of stuff. You get more Positive America. That includes our new show, which is called Positive America Only Friends.
It's where Dan gets naked.
Where Dan gets full frontal nudity, but mostly it's a bi-weekly subscription exclusive podcast that is basically Positive America, but behind a paywall. So it's a little bit looser and more fun. And it's Lovett and Favreau and me and Pfeiffer and then other Crooked hosts. We go deeper on the news and cover more stories. You also get Open Tabs, which is a weekly behind-the-scenes newsletter from the show. Plus, you get ad-free episodes of your favorite Crooked podcasts and all kinds of other stuff. Dan will come to your house and clean it once every quarter.
Yeah, clothed.
Dan is very busy, clothed only. But along with just getting great content, becoming a friend of the pod, joining our subscription community, is the number one thing you can do to help us grow, to help independent progressive media. So if you've ever thought about doing it, if you ever wanted more Pod Save America, consider going to crooked.com/friends and becoming a friend of the pod.
Are you concerned about microplastics in your home? Blue Land makes it easy to make sustainable choices. Blue Land cleaning sprays, toilet bowl cleaner, and dishwasher and laundry detergent tablets are free from dyes, parabens, and harsh chemicals. Blue Land is a certified B Corp and Leaping Bunny cruelty-free certified. Their formulas are EPA Safer Choice certified, and many products have also earned Cradle to Cradle's Gold Material Health Certificate. Get 15% off your first order by going to blueland.com/crooked. blueland.com/crooked.
All right. Do we want to talk about the big scene, the Juilliard scene?
Sure.
Okay. Let's start. We got a clip of it, and then we'll get into it.
Now the
big question for you is, what do you think, Max?
You play really well. But nowadays, white male cis composers, just not my thing.
Don't be so eager to be offended. The narcissism of small differences leads to the most boring conformity.
All right, John, you saw this scene for the first time. When did your, or did your sympathies flip in the scene?
What she says to him right before he says, like, you're a bitch, fuck off.
Where she's just humiliating him in front of the, making him
there was
sit
a
the
way,
bench.
Because up until that point, I'm like, maybe she's going to try to persuade him in an interesting way.
Right.
Because again, like and that scene too is like the first time you see her really interact with people. Mm-hmm. And so initially I was like, oh, I wonder if she'll just be one of these monsters in a way where she's just like tough on students and yelling at everyone all the time because she's like an important, you know. And then at the beginning of the scene, she kind of seems like she's going to try to teach or empathize with them or whatever else. So I was like, oh, interesting. Mm-hmm. Maybe Max needs to just like settle down for a second, you know? And then by then you're like, oh, I get it.
Right. She's great. She's a bully and she's using her power. Yeah. I thought it was, I really liked the way they played it, that at first she is trying to teach him because you can see she really does love the music. And it is, there is something deep down within her that is genuine, that she really does love Bach. She really does love the way that it's composed.
And there's a completely legitimate debate over over that.
The art versus the artist. Yep. Yeah. Which is something that they could have spent half the movie getting into that. And I was glad that they just kind of acknowledged it and sidestepped it. Amanda, what was it like watching this for the third time? Were you kind of bracing the whole time for the tar monster to come out?
Yeah. I mean, it's obviously like she can't handle her perspective not being shared by everyone. You know, it's not just that she wants them to be aware of this other perspective. But I also felt like, to me, like, one of the falsest parts of the movie is when Max says, as a BIPOC pangender person.
I agree. I was going to bring this up later.
It's
the one wrong note in the movie, I feel.
I could see him putting those two words on his Twitter bio, but I don't think he says that to Tar in that way. You know, it did make me feel like, you know, was that put in order for me to throw my support more to Tar, you know, because he sounds ridiculous in this way that sounds false to me. But
I agree.
You could have made him sound a little more ridiculous without having him doing this like artificial identifying.
The fact that he sounds like a Barry Weiss column version of someone she made up to get mad at is not super helpful for that. Yeah. No, I agree with that.
Yeah. And you can sort of like, once that scene becomes this hatchet job viral video, like, you can see something like that becoming a part of it when it sort of becomes her like phobic object or whatever. Like, it like contains everything that she hates about like these students or whatever. But in this like scene that's supposed to be very realistic, I just didn't buy that particular.
Yeah, it did feel like they were putting their finger a little bit too hard on the like, you're supposed to find him annoying and ridiculous. And it's like, listen, he's a child. I already find him annoying and ridiculous. You don't have to tell me.
You're pushing on an open door.
Absolutely. If he's 19, it's like, come on. I thought it was so funny. I only caught this time around. She makes a Rene Redzepi reference in the start of the monologue. Did you guys catch this? The celebrity chef at Noma, the like 5 Michelin star Copenhagen restaurant, which I thought was such a great way to convey that, like, she doesn't know how to talk to anyone who is not her usual, like, New Yorker festival audience. She's talking to a bunch of Juilliard students, and she's like, oh, Rene Redzepi, right, kids?
Yeah, I mean, Tara's constantly making references that, like, I don't understand, which is part of her charm.
That's the idea, is it's a little power cudgel that she wields, that like, oh, you don't know the references, which is definitely very real. I have met those people, unfortunately, and they love to drop their little references so that you
even though she's like met by these blank looks from the students who like we have no idea what you're talking about.
For example, I didn't know what you were talking about when you said that was the chef. Didn't know that.
I mean,
I didn't know the Noma reference. I was like, okay, that one I got. I've heard of that reference. restaurant.
I admittedly,
but even that puts me in, like, you know.
I had to Google it. I've not been to Copenhagen. I've not been to NoMA. I did watch the first two seasons of The Bear, which does make me a culinary expert.
Oh, yeah,
and
no,
I think they
it.
Reference Rene Redzepi.
Okay, cool.
So, which is just as annoying, frankly, but at least they hold your hand a little bit through it. I was also really struck by the irony of her specifically belittling this Icelandic atonal composer. And the very first scene of the movie is her doing her field work with, like, atonal Peruvian indigenous music. And it really shows you how she has betrayed her own origins and how she's gone from the young person who wants to challenge things to the old who's bought into the status quo.
But I also thought that's very typical of people like this.
Oh, sure.
Which is, yeah, like, I'm gonna go do my anthropology to some some far off place so I can seem very cultured and in touch with another, you
oh,
know,
you didn't
with
think
other
she was genuine in her love for the Peruvian?
No, I think it's just like something she did because she knew it was gonna look good on the resume and that she could talk about at parties and in
sure.
discussions with Adam Gopnik years later. I really did. That's my cynical view of that.
I buy that she in her youth was authentically into it. And you hear her speaking the like indigenous Peruvian language,
yeah,
on the tape. But it can be both, for sure. It can be both.
To me, the thing that's interesting about that choice is that the Tar score was written by a female Icelandic composer.
Which I thought was supposed to be a little joke, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm just like really fascinated by how much Todd Field is like talking about himself when he's talking about this stuff. You know, he's the director of this movie that is incredibly controlled, like obsessively controlled.
Yeah.
And he, you know, like his first movie was a Woody Allen movie. He worked for Stanley Kubrick, obviously. And so you know, he's also a musician. And so he knows a lot about that world, like way more than I do. I'm like vaguely aware of what he's talking about, but I did wonder, you know, how much he's trying to talk about his own movie making when he is making this movie.
Right. And of course, like you mentioned, he was in a Kubrick movie. He was in Eyes Wide Shut and talked a lot about watching Kubrick and trying to learn his filmmaking style, which is sociopathic in how controlling it is. And it does look like he's very much trying to like reproduce that in Tar, which I thought he did an amazing job with. But yes, I'm sure you're right that he is to some degree talking about his own filmmaking style. I have a quote from him about the Juilliard scene. Really the impetus for writing it, I think, which is an age old question. What would your older self tell your younger self? Which I think is such an interesting way to read the scene. This version of these two individuals, one is 50, the other is half that age. The younger one is very much like Lydia Tarr when she was 25. And then that poses the question, quote, why does she go after this student? Which I thought is interesting. The idea that she is attacking the younger version of herself because she understands that is threatening now. That is a really, really smart way to read that scene. All right, what do we think of the ending? The ending that everybody got so mad at.
Okay, now you guys got to tell me, why do people get mad at the ending?
So, Amanda, you were deep in this.
Okay, so the ending is like where Tar goes to, I guess in the movie, ultimately, it's an unnamed Asian country.
I think it is supposed to be the Philippines.
It is. I thought it was Thailand. So why did I think it was Thailand?
Well, I think it was filmed in Thailand.
It's got a sex trafficking.
Oh.
Oh, okay.
But I think it's, you know, I think it was filmed in Thailand, but they reference like the Marlon Brando movie that brought the alligators to the river, which I think is
right.
a reference
Apocalypse
to,
now.
Yeah, which was filmed in the Philippines, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Anyway, so she's there and she gets her like new post-cancellation job, which is conducting a youth orchestra for like a monster hunter cosplay concert, which is a video game. And so she basically becomes like a live, she's like conducting to a video game score, which is, I guess, like her ultimate nightmare that she's stuck in this robot world now. But she seems to be like thriving there also.
Mm-hmm.
She seems to be taking it very seriously. I'm not sure why people dislike this. I think like there's this idea that like it ended on a joke.
Yeah, I think people,
I
my
loved
sense
it.
Is that I loved it as well, and we should talk about like how we read it. My sense is that people got mad about it either because they thought it was a joke at the expense of, I guess, Southeast Asian video game music fangoing culture, or they thought that it was, which I think it's fine to say that's less prestigious than the Berlin Philharmonic. I was not particularly offended by that. But in any case, or the thing people were offended by was they felt that it was too redemptive. And they would say, well, she had a big realization at the end and we're tired of seeing, you know, groomers and abusers be redeemed. I would say that I did not read it that way.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely saw it. I read it as her being so obsessed with Western culture and herself dismissive in like a few sort of lines that are throwaways where she sort of indicates a dismissal of other like musical traditions. But I also like the idea of it being redemptive. I mean, A, Lydia Tarr is not real. She's not real. She can't hurt you. It's a movie. I don't see it as a redemption. I do see it as like a confirmation that she like really loves what she does, which is kind of interesting.
I think that was my reaction.
Yeah.
Or that she realized at some point towards the end when she was losing everything that this is all she has. She doesn't have relationships except her. In her mind, I guess, her relationship with her daughter, which we could debate whether that's a healthy relationship. Right. I don't know what that
it's ended is the implication, too.
Right. And then there's no other relationships in life, and all she has is the music. Mm-hmm. And so it's it ends on, like, a funny note there.
Right.
But I think she is I think there's a mix, right? She's genuinely happy that she is playing again.
Right.
Or that she is conducting again, right? Mm-hmm. But I don't think it's redemptive at all in the sense that, like, she's so isolated by the end and alienated and being in whatever the culture is where she doesn't necessarily speak the language or hasn't been there. Like, it just, she feels like she's so on an island that I thought it was a good description of like what happens to someone who has a fall from grace like this, who's a public figure.
It's a climb their way.
And then the real tough thing to go through is that like all of your connections are just lost to the world that you once had.
Right.
So it is this sort of like, this death.
Yeah.
And she starts anew, but she's completely alone.
The two scenes that I thought were really telling for her kind of like, because I think you're right, it is a kind of death or kind of rebirth after this, is obviously the big one is when she goes to the massage parlor and she realizes what it actually is. Mm-hmm. It's actually a house of prostitution. And she's like, all these women are arrayed before her. And a woman who is in the exact position that Olga is in the orchestra makes eye contact with her.
Yeah.
And then she realizes who she is and she goes out and she throws up. But I thought the other really key scene that I don't hear people talk about as much is when she goes to the waterfall and she's hiding behind the waterfall and she sees these two young people kissing, where it's like she is seeing the humanity of someone outside of herself, and she's seeing a real genuine emotional connection between two people, kind of for the first time in her life.
And that's not redemptive, because that's just, I think that's like deep sadness.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, she's right, because she's caught behind the waterfall, and like, see, that is closed off to her now. She's not going to have that in her own life. I mean, the woman who makes eye contact with her also in the massage parlor is number 5, which is like the symphony that she is conducting.
Oh, right. Todd, you did it again.
I know. Todd is like, Todd's a wild one. Like, I am very interested in him. I hope that he makes another movie.
I know. I do too. All right. Do we have anything else before we move on to what the biggest thing the movie gets wrong?
No.
Okay. For me, I really agree with you, Amanda. I think that the movie overplays its hands with the phrase BIPOC pangender and just tips us too hard into telling us how to feel about the characters in a way that I think really like fed into the backlash of the movie, because people took a message from it that it's about, it's, you know, waving its hands at cancel culture and the young wokes who were so upset about. And there was the Venice Film Festival, when it screened, the crowd cheered during the Juilliard scene when she's dressing down that kid.
No way.
Yes, they cheered. It's a very funny case of people who should really know better, like wildly meeting the movie.
That is amazing.
But it's also such a funny moment because like that's the New Yorker festival crowd. Do you know what I mean? Those are the people who are bought into the power structure that's being, I feel, indicted in the movie, who were like, yeah, fucking get his ass, Lydia.
Oh, my God. I mean, I would argue that there are things that appear wrong with the internet that are that it's purposeful, because it's a reflection of how Lydia Tarr sees the internet, which is like through this completely distorted lens. But that part, I think, is not. And so I agree. To me, that was like the most off note in the movie.
My biggest thing and smallest thing are both like same scene. Smallest thing. Why did anyone let her in the performance in a tuxedo where she was standing next to the guy with the trumpet? Why was she there?
That was what I watched it last night with Julia, and she was like, the trumpet player's not going to notice.
That's crazy. No one's going to notice her walking in. And then
she's got her key card.
After she physically assaults the conductor.
Great scene.
Great scene. But I was like, I feel like she would have been canceled a lot harder after that, right? That's not just like public shame. Like, why wasn't she like led away and handcuffed,
taken to jail,
and taken to jail?
I believe maybe she spent a night in the slammer.
You think
it
so?
Wouldn't shock me.
I just felt like that was her tackling him was like tipped it over into
it's a little melodrama.
There's going to be no other gigs for Lydia Tarr after this.
Not even in Manila.
Not in Manila.
I would book her. I'd book her in a heartbeat. Lydia, you're welcome here anytime.
There's a whole internet discourse that's like the last third of the movie isn't real. Like, it's something that's like a hallucination that happens in Lydia Tarr's mind after she like bonks her head on the stairs, which I don't agree with. But it's certainly like the fact that the trumpet player does not even see her is odd.
He's locked in. He's got that. Yeah. He's going Mahler mode. What do you guys make of the score disappearing from Tarr's apartment? That for me felt like a loose end that was just like never explained.
Oh yeah, my reaction to that was, what, you don't have this on a hard drive somewhere? really? That's only on paper?
I don't know how to do that. I don't know if conductors keep it
on
like
a jump
Microsoft
drive
Word
even or anything. Okay. Sure.
Well, this is what the movie is about. It's about the importance of digital backups. Don't keep hard copies.
That's why it's off my movie club.
That's right.
I mean, my theory now is like Francesca before her rampage, like just did a bunch of mischief. Especially like if Tarr's wife doesn't really know what's going on. She is her assistant. She can sort of come in and pick something up or whatever.
Right. And they're all popping pills, apparently.
That to me is the most literal. I know. Yeah. But we also, like, in the background see Krista a couple of times after she died. Like, figures appear like Krista. Yeah. Also need some Reddit links. There's one. There's one that we see her once in Tarr's flat, like in her studio, before we know that Krista is dead. But by the timeline, Krista is dead. Yeah, she's sitting. She's like standing in the kitchen, and then again we see her later when Petra calls her and asks her to come in to her room and hold her foot. We can see Krista sitting in a chair in the dark.
Really? I can't believe I missed that.
I know. Also, to do it's like it's in the script, in the shooting script too. So it's like a real thing. But there's this. I don't know if like she's literally supposed to be a ghost. There's a tweet that I love. I don't remember who tweeted it, but it's something like when there was this whole debate as to whether the end of Tarr was a dream. Someone was like. Maybe Tarr isn't real and it's not a dream. It's a third thing, a movie. And I do think like it's a movie. And so like Todd Field is making all of these moves that are allegorical or whatever. But I do think there's supposed to be maybe a plausible literal explanation for why these things are happening. And then maybe a slightly supernatural cast to like the skeletons in her closet coming out.
That's what I took it as, like her subconscious haunting her and like waking up in the middle of the night and the metronome is going crazy. Is like she equates herself with time. So like time is losing control or like time is out of control. So Lydia Tarr is losing control of the world around her. And the dog is her being haunted by she understands that she's putting herself in danger. That's what I kind of took it all as metaphorical. Moment you most related to personally. Boy, I had a much larger list here than I would have hoped for in a movie about somebody like this. This is a much, much bigger section of my Google Doc than is ideal, to be honest. Getting older and can't sleep through the damn night. I related to that one. That one tracks. Listening to NPR in the morning and repeating back weird enunciations.
Wow.
Do you guys, does everybody not do this?
No.
I don't, the number of times I've been like in the shower and there's someone on NPR and they like pronounce something a weird way, like you have to say it back. You guys are missing out. I'm telling you, try it. It's fun. It's fun.
Wow.
That's great.
Okay.
Okay.
I had more, but somebody else should save me from my shame and embarrassment here.
I mean, for me, it's like not to this extent, obviously, but when you're an assistant to a person, that person plays this enormous role in your life and you're like small to them. And so this idea that all of these assistants have like kind of a parasocial relationship with their own boss that is only like maybe sometimes vaguely connected to like what she's actually doing and who she is as a person, I felt like seemed incredibly realistic.
Wait, so who was your Lydia Tarr then?
I mean, I don't think I had a Lydia Tarr, although I would say like not like with the sex stuff, but there is certainly like there's a dynamic between, I think, like if you're in an industry that used to be dominated by men, like there's a dynamic of like the first woman to really like break through who then like manages younger women where it's like she had to be more of a man than a man in order to survive and sort of like expects you to like do the same. But you're like, well, this isn't true of me. Like I'm, you know, I'm surrounded by women or whatever. So I think that's something that does happen.
Yeah, her whole line in the New Yorker thing about they don't call them astronauts, that rang so familiar. There's so many, I feel like I've encountered so many older women who were very successful, who were like, just pretend gender doesn't exist. Just pretend it doesn't exist, which is like very self-serving once you're in the position of power. But I thought rang really true.
It's a small thing, but the PR team... the PR teams throughout. There's one in Berlin, and then there's one at the very end.
Right.
And just like the advice that crisis comms people give is just so. There's another part where I just laughed really hard, and I've just like heard it so many times.
I'm sure
in like working in campaigns and consulting and all that kind of stuff, and it's just like, you know, we're gonna like start small, and we need to tell a different story.
Yeah,
we need to tell a different story.
It did that moment for me shed a lot of light in 2008 when you guys had Barack Obama go to Manila and relocate there and just give big inspiring speeches in the backwoods of the Philippines. I was like, oh, that's how that happened. I get this now.
We got to rebuild. Start small.
The part that I did sincerely relate to is the feeling of, and Zadie Smith talks about this in her essay, of like when you realize you have gone from the young guard to the old guard, and that's like a very destabilizing moment. And like being the like one time, you know, young progressive groundbreaker who now you like look around and you see everybody around you, like they're the young progressive groundbreakers now. And they just kind of assume that you are like, defender of the status quo conservative. And you want to tell them like, no, wait, I was and continue in my mind to be you.
Well, it's not just the politics, though, because that, you know, I've seen before and felt before, but she goes on to say, she's like, what's wrong with these people is that they are going to die. And for the first time in their lives, they really know that.
Yes.
And so she's like, equates it with having a midlife crisis.
Right.
And I never thought about a midlife. It's not just that you're seeing these younger generations, but you're also seeing like, the end is coming. And now what do I do?
Mm-hmm.
And then she was also saying like, and maybe because the end of our time and the end of time itself has become somewhat muddled in our minds, which is also very true and very online.
And very Gen X, frankly.
Very Gen X. And a little millennial too.
Right. Yeah. But yeah, it definitely gave me a flashback to every time in the last couple of years, especially, or the last year, I should say, especially, I have been having a discussion with someone about the Israel-Palestine conflict, and I will see that they're polite about it. I will see behind their eyes that they assume, like, oh, you used to work for the New York Times, so I assume you have a certain set of views that I disagree with and don't like. And I, like, really have to stop myself from launching into a soliloquy about, like, you don't know the things that I did to, like, challenge the status quo or, like, move things in a certain direction, but then stop myself because I remember that was 10 years ago and it doesn't actually count for anything anymore. And it's like, oh, no, okay, that's a little Lydia Tarr. Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah.
We have all worked with a Sebastian who annoys the shit out of us, even if their work is great. The pen clicking.
I've
worked with that guy. I've worked with the pen clicker.
To me, like the most relatable moment in the movie is when we hear all of this stuff about how Tarr like doesn't read reviews, like she hates social media. And then we see her type at Tarr into the Twitter search bar to like see what people are saying about her book talk.
Mm-hmm.
That was great.
You know what I hate is when your subconscious torments you with your misdeeds by manifesting your guilt as an ethereal wolf. That's the worst, right, guys? Right,
and then
guys?
You fall flat on your face.
Right, and then you injure yourself physically. Yeah, mm-hmm. That's right. That's always the
tough
worst
one.
The only other one I had was getting hauled in front of bosses, I guess in Lydia Tarr's case, the board, over a tweet. That's definitely happened to me. I've definitely had a couple of those.
Yeah, for sure.
In my case, it was tweeting that the one I got in the most trouble for was when I tweeted that John Kelly watching an early Trump speech, he looked like Mr. Wilson after Dennis the Menace put a flaming bag of poop on his front yard.
What the hell is the problem with that?
I got in so much trouble for that tweet.
Pretty tame.
Wow.
I thought so.
Yeah.
That was my case.
Are you concerned about microplastics in your home? Blue Land makes it easy to make sustainable choices. Blue Land cleaning sprays, toilet bowl cleaner, and dishwasher and laundry detergent tablets are free from dyes, parabens, and harsh chemicals. Blue Land is a certified B Corp and Leaping Bunny cruelty-free certified. Their formulas are EPA Safer Choice certified, and many products have also earned Cradle to Cradle's Gold Material Health Certificate. Get 15% off your first order by going to blueland.com/crooked. blueland.com/crooked.
If you guys like Pod Save America, please consider subscribing to our Friends of the Pod program. So Friends of the Pod get lots of stuff. You get more Pod Save America. That includes our new show, which is called Pod Save America Only Friends.
It's where Dan gets naked.
Where Dan gets full frontal nudity, but mostly it's a bi-weekly subscription-exclusive podcast that is basically Pod Save America, but behind a paywall. So it's a little bit looser and more fun. And it's Lovett and Favreau and me and Pfeiffer and then other Crooked hosts. We go deeper on the news and cover more stories. You also get Open Tabs, which is a weekly behind-the-scenes newsletter from the show. Plus, you get ad-free episodes of your favorite Crooked podcasts and all kinds of other stuff. Dan will come to your house and clean it once every quarter.
Yeah, clothed.
Dan is very busy, clothed only. But along with just getting great content, becoming a friend of the pod, joining our subscription community is the number one thing you can do to help us grow, to help independent progressive media. So if you've ever thought about doing it, if you ever wanted more Pod Save America, consider going to crooked.com/friends and becoming a friend of the pod.
Are you concerned about microplastics in your home? Blue Land makes it easy to make sustainable choices. Blue Land cleaning sprays, toilet bowl cleaner, and dishwasher and laundry detergent tablets are free from dyes, parabens, and harsh chemicals. Blue Land is a certified B Corp and Leaping Bunny cruelty-free certified. Their formulas are EPA Safer Choice certified, and many products have also earned Cradle to Cradle's Gold Material Health Certificate. Get 15% off your first order by going to blueland.com/crooked. blueland.com/crooked.
I don't know if it was unintentional or not, but Olga, that scene where they're eating together, mm-hmm. and Olga tells her that she knows the music from seeing someone play it on YouTube.
On YouTube. Yeah.
And then at some point says, I don't know who the conductor was.
Yeah.
And you could just see the look on Tar's face. And she was like, but yet she loves her and welcomes her in and chooses
which
her.
Which is a great contrast even with the Juilliard scene.
Right, because even though she's done maybe like the worst thing you could possibly do to Lydia Tarr, which is dismiss the importance of a conductor.
Right. Yeah, it does. I think that is it's a great contrast with the Juilliard scene because it shows, okay, she's willing to throw all of that out the window when she's found a new young person to exploit.
I mean, I don't think that Todd Field wants there to be any unintentionally revealing moment in this movie. I think he's intended for every moment to be revealing, to the extent that, like, you know, the nursery rhyme that she's repeating with Petra in the car is about, like, you know, all of these animals getting together to, like, kill rooster.
Yes.
She, like, animal references the Jabberwocky, which is, also about, like, killing this monster. But to me, like, for me, when she goes home and she watches the Leonard Bernstein tapes in her house, like, and she's crying, like, to me, that's when I realized, like, this is supposed to be the most emotional moment of this movie, and, like, I'm not really moved by this. And I think there's something about the movie just being so controlled that I, even though, like, I find Lydia Tarr to be, like, a really interesting puzzle and I'm interested in her, I didn't completely, like, empathize with her. At the end,
it's
it just
so
didn't
funny.
Really move me.
I did find that scene to be a little emotionally affecting. The close shot on her eyes when we first hear Leonard Bernstein talking about, like, the joy of the music. And I think he's supposed to be talking to kids. And you see her nod a little bit. I was like, oh, there is a real person deep down inside here who really does care about music. But I don't know. Maybe I just feel more. I don't know what to tell you.
Linda Tarr. Two R's.
The only thing I really had here was the extremely Gen X preoccupation with authenticity. That's like her big redemption at the end. It's just she connects with her authentic self as extremely Gen X, which this whole movie is like one of the most Gen X movies I've ever seen. And then other than that, just like the reception to it, I found very revealing, which is not something you can put on the movie, but the fact that everybody was upset at the movie for not specifically confirming their views on quote unquote cancel culture, and that's not even what the movie was really about.
Yeah.
I felt was like very telling. Biggest real world impact?
That a lot of people were trying to Google whether Lydia Tarr is real or not.
She's real if you believe her.
There's a debate.
She's real in your heart.
Seems like
I love a world where, like, this is what biopics look like. Like, people make biopics of real people and they're this movie. Like, I welcome that. I think every real person should have a Tarr-style movie made about them.
There was a whole New York Magazine really went off on the whole Lydia Tarr is real thing and had a number of like SEO explainers about her. And there's one that I will quote later when we get to the true or false section, 49 facts about Lydia Tarr, where the URL, this is so funny, is who is Lydia Tarr Cate Blanchett biopic real? That was a great bit. The biggest impact was that it made me extremely mad at the Oscars because my boy Todd got robbed, my girl Kate got robbed, Everything Everywhere All at Once, it's fine.
Three and a half stars. Who won instead of Cate Blanchett?
Michelle Yeoh.
Oh, right.
She got a kind of like, we're so proud of you for all you've sacrificed.
Cate Blanchett did it.
Come on, she's great.
It was.
I know she already has 17
hated
Oscars.
That choice.
We were all waiting for a certain someone when Michelle Yeoh was up on that stage to come out of the wings and make their presence felt
By the trumpet.
That's right. Yeah.
I did want there to be like a big Oscars skit with Tarr, but I'm sure that no one saw the movie. I don't know. I guess no one watches the Oscars anyway, so who cares?
Yeah. Yeah, who cares, Oscars? What would be different if it came out today? I think the reception would be really different. I really think that people would move. Oh, yeah. I think that we're just
two steps
further. Yeah, I mean, it's twice as far away from 2020. I think people are like a little chiller about all this stuff now and ready to look at it with a little bit more remove. I do also think that, again, the like BIPOC pangender, I think they would be a little bit more, a little smarter about how to present the Max character.
Mm. I could see that.
Yeah.
I think there's something that's like on the tip of the movie's tongue all the time where like she talks about how she conducted in Israel. She's in this very Jewish philanthropy world. Like she's talking about Jewish figures all the time. She cites Hebrew. Like I don't see how those elements stay in the movie and there's not some kind of Israel relationship to her cancellation. It just seems like it's almost there.
Right.
There's also this trailer for the movie that has all of these images that never showed up in the movie. And one of them is Tarr like moving backwards through the Berlin Holocaust Memorial. And, you know, like we previously talking about the cancellation of Nazis alongside sexual predators. Right. And so there's something going on there in the movie that's like just under the surface. And I'm not totally sure what it is. And I feel like maybe it would have made it a worse movie, but I feel like something from that would need to sort of come out more explicitly in campus conversation.
Right.
You know,
you would definitely pull that thread out more. Yeah, I agree. I didn't put that together, but the all of the Hebrew and the references to Israel do feel very pointed and they don't feel accidental.
Mm. I think maybe if it came out today, they would have given her a podcast.
Listen, we've got extra microphones here. Lydia Tarr wants a podcast. She's got a podcast.
Podcaster and quite successful there.
Oh, yeah. No, that's true. That
I
would
mean,
definitely. She would be on Russell Brand. Mm.
Yes.
She does appear on Alec. She appears on Alec Baldwin's podcast in the movie. I don't know if you caught that. She's like interviewed by Alec Baldwin, who like went on to accidentally kill a woman, you know, which is very odd. So I'm not sure. It's great that it happens in the movie. I'm not sure that it would happen after that event, but
yeah, that's true.
Oh yeah, having Alec Baldwin in there would feel a little bit more pointed.
I mean, it already feels on the nose, but you know, after that, it's yeah.
I love that in the first 15 minutes, they're like really rubbing our noses in the like manufacture of high culture and making it feel so like these are the steps. And then you talk to Alec Baldwin and then you like go out with your rich financier, but you belittle him a little bit because that's part of how you maintain the power dynamic, even though the Mark Strong character is like funding you and giving you his private jet. I thought all of those dynamics were so great and they're so funny. All right, well, we are going to finish things off with our traditional round of true or false. I'm going to read out a series of quotes, plot points in the movie. You tell me if you agree, disagree with them. True or false is a quote from Todd Field. If this story was about a white male, you'd know how to feel in 5 seconds.
True.
True.
Yeah, I think true. Quote from Andrus that we played earlier. Nowadays, to be accused is the same as being guilty, but then he goes on to suggest maybe it was actually always like that. I think there's truth to that. I think it's uncomfortable to acknowledge because it feels like a concession to a cancel culture narrative that therefore there's not real underlying guilt, which is that so often used as a deflection to be like, oh, if you're accused, you're the same as guilty. But, you know, that's part of how, you know, conforming people to social norms works.
I'd say generally true, slightly less true than maybe it was even at the time of the movie.
Yes. Yeah.
It's very true that Andrus would say that because when she brought it up, he was very alarmed that someone could have said something about him. Obviously, like he's had incidents in his past.
I thought that was the funniest part of the movie. Yes. Yeah. He's immediately like, if someone say something, I'm out of the game.
Yeah. They can't even bring me down because I'm as low as I could be.
Right.
Yeah, they're going to take my driver away. So, yes, I think he's right, but it's also right that someone guilty would say that.
Yes, I agree with both of those. Quote from Adam Gopnik, tar on tar is the perfect stocking stuffer. It's true. That's absolutely true.
I would absolutely tar on tar.
A signed copy of Tar on Tar. Oh, that's what's better than that.
Oh, my God.
All right, let's do, I'm going to do a few rapid fire ones from the Juilliard scene. And there are a bunch of these, so we'll try to go through them quickly. These are all Lydia Tarr quotes from that scene. Unfortunately, the architect of your soul appears to be social media.
True.
It's true for you and me. I don't know. Amanda, I'm not going to implicate you here, but I would say it's true for probably.
Yeah, it's
very
true.
Unfortunate.
Okay. Don't be so eager to be offended. The narcissism of small differences leads to the most boring conformity. I'm going to say she snapped with that one. I think she's right.
I think that's true.
Yeah. You hate to side with her in this scene because she is a monster, but she's not wrong the time.
Yeah, her general point is correct. Not in that instance.
No, the way she's applying it is not correct. Yeah. Okay. Quote, you want to dance the mask, you must service the composer. I don't know what that means. I'll be honest.
I don't know what that means, but I love it. I'm going to say yes. Absolutely.
Okay,
that's true.
Perfect.
Quote, how is mask? What is mask?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know, but it sounds true. It's just such authority.
Yeah.
All right. Quote, you have to sublimate yourself, your ego, and yes, your identity. You must, in fact, stand in front of the public and God and obliterate yourself. I'm going to say false.
I don't think that's what Tarr's doing.
That's definitely the opposite of what she's doing. Yeah. She is all about manufacturing identity. Quote, it is always the question that involves the listener. It's never the answer.
I also didn't quite know what that meant.
I always like that. I was going to say true because I feel like, look, as a longtime practitioner of explainer journalism, that's how you pull them in. You give them the big question. And what is Tarr if not an explainer journalist?
Tarr starts out this monologue like spitting truth, but then she sort of becomes like a magic eight ball of like whatever.
Yes, totally.
You might say that she's high in her own supply.
Yeah.
All right. Two from the Zadie Smith essay. Quote, it's a long climb down from cultural luminary to contra and no doubt a great shock to find yourself so sharply reassessed and redefined by the generation below you. That is 5 green lights true.
True.
Yeah. Ultra true.
I'll say true. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. Quote, the very phrase ad hominem has been rendered obsolete, almost incomprehensible online. A person is the position they're maintaining and vice versa. Opinions are identities and identities are opinions.
1000% true.
Yeah.
No.
Whoa.
I don't agree with that.
Okay.
Ooh, let's talk about it.
Yeah. Why not?
I mean, it's just not, that's not true. Like, Zadie Smith gets to write this whole freaking essay in, you know, what is it? The LARB? And she wrote it like the next year after Tar came out. It's like, and she didn't even have to write it. Like, she, people get to have their opinions at length still.
Oh, I think that's true.
I guess I'm
thinking about, like, and maybe I've spent too much time in political Twitter.
Yes.
But you really are, which maybe, sorry. Sorry for the maybe. But your opinions are, like, whatever someone's tweeting, whatever their takes are,
right.
that's who that person is. There are no other sides to that person.
Right.
There's no nuance or complexity to that person. You are your takes.
You had a take that I didn't like, and that's what I'm going to associate with you. Yes.
Yes. Unless you meet the person in real life and you're like, oh, that person sucked online, but I actually like them in real life.
I will. This is kind of like agreeing with Lydia Tarr in the Juilliard scene, to be honest with you, where it's like, I really agree with what Zadie Smith is saying, and I feel slightly uncomfortable and old articulating that. So I will say it is true in some contexts, and there are other contexts where that defense is used inappropriately, mm-hmm. is how I'm going to forgive myself for it. All right. Now we're going to do, I know we're doing so many true and falses, but this is just, it's a perfect movie for it. We're going to do a few from the Vulture article, 49 True Facts About Lydia Tarr by Jason okay. Frank and Rebecca Alter. An incredible piece. Quote, Interview magazine had to issue a correction following its Lydia Tarr and Lin-Manuel Miranda interview when Page Six revealed that Tarr lied about having seen Hamilton. True. She did it. She did that shit.
False.
Okay.
I think she would be open about not seeing Hamilton.
Yes.
She'd
hold it up as a badge of honor.
That's true. Yeah. She would love to brag about that. Yeah.
She would also never sit down with Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Oh, come on. She would do it. She would do it because there'd be something in it for her. A little publicity for Tarr on Tarr. If you search Ghislaine Maxwell, Lydia Tarr, and Getty Images, you get 49 hits.
That says more
about Ghislaine than about Lydia Tarr, I think, because she's just everywhere.
Yeah. There's a lot of Reddit links about those images, too, and about what's really going on in those photos. Kate McKinnon once depicted Tarr in a cut-for-time SNL sketch that has been called, quote, my personal David Pumpkins by more than one Brooklyn-based queer comedian.
It starts out yes, and then it goes to a false.
Same with me. All right.
True or false, the most annoying imaginable way to respond to someone in conversation is by saying very punct contrapunct. That's it. I think no one has been more annoying than Lydia Tarr was in that moment.
I'm going to start using that.
Yeah.
I'm going to have them shut off your mic. True or false, in a pinch, jail can be rhymed with hell. In the accordion scene.
Oh.
You're all going to hell. Your sister's
your mom
in jail.
Is in jail.
Yes.
Which we didn't really talk about. You kind of referenced this. I thought that scene was very good at conveying the like ego death that comes with being mega canceled mm-hmm. online and like what that feels like. And it really does feel terrible.
But it's also it true that everything she says in that song is correct.
Right. Yeah, no, she's absolutely right.
They banished their sister to an institution to sell her apartment. Like, that is wrong. And Tarr is right.
Yeah. Oh, the scene when they knock on the door and they ask, what times do you play music? She does a little pow. Another great laugh moment.
Mm. Yes.
This movie is a comedy.
Incredible. That's very funny.
True or false, if you were to recount a story about a 19th century composer mistreating his wife and you wanted to end it in a way that showed how hip and online you were, it would be by saying, quote, hashtag rules of the game. Lydia Tarr, explain a hashtag. What do you think a hashtag is? What rules? What of what game? What is she talking about?
Now that you mentioned that moment, that was one moment I should have written it down. I was like, what were they doing here? What was she doing?
Hashtag rules the game, John. Hashtag rules the game. All right. Last one. This is a quote from Lydia Tarr, an ironclad rebuttal to any accusation, quote, for a start, this happened in a tech-free zone. She's right. It's a tech-free zone. You can't be mad at her for anything she said in a tech-free zone. You can't be mad at her for anything she did or said.
Yeah. So funny.
Yeah. If they brought in a phone, it was them. It was they. It was on them. So, yes.
take it all off the internet now.
That's right.
We caught him on a technicality.
Start over. It's over. Well, pals, thank you so much for joining me in the tech-free zone that was watching Tar, one of my favorites.
Thanks, guys.
I'm so excited that I finally watched it.
I am too.
And now in the discourse, I love it.
Yeah, and now we're going to have Kate on. Offline Movie Club is a Crooked Media production. It's written and hosted by me, Max Fisher. It's produced by Emma Illick-Frank. Mixed and edited by Charlotte Landis, with audio support from Kyle Seglin and Vasilis Fotopoulos. Jordan Katz and Kenny Siegel take care of our music. Thanks to Ari Schwartz, Madeline Herringer, and Adrian Hill for production support.
If you guys like Positive America, please consider subscribing to our Friends of the Pod program. So Friends of the Pod get lots of stuff. You get more Positive America. That includes our new show, which is called Positive America Only Friends.
It's where Dan gets naked.
Where Dan gets full frontal nudity, but mostly it's a bi-weekly subscription-exclusive podcast that is basically Positive America, but behind a paywall. So it's a little bit looser and more fun. And it's Lovett and Favreau and me and Pfeiffer and then other Crooked hosts. We go deeper on the news and cover more stories. You also get Open Tabs, which is a weekly behind-the-scenes newsletter from the show. Plus, you get ad-free episodes of your favorite Crooked podcasts and all kinds of other stuff. Dan will come to your house and clean it once every quarter.
Yeah, clothed.
Dan is very busy, clothed only. But along with just getting great content, becoming a friend of the pod, joining our subscription community, is the number one thing you can do to help us grow, to help independent progressive media. So if you've ever thought about doing it, if you ever wanted more Pod Save America, consider going to crooked.com/friends and becoming a friend of the pod.